Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
My fellow Americans, another year, another State of the Union, one corporate slice of tomorrow's speech coming up. Also, our new segment, I Always Wondered. And hey, Google, you looking to buy a public radio show in mint condition? Call me. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Great to have you here on a Monday, everybody. This is the Marketplace podcast for the 27th of January, which means that tomorrow night, Tuesday the 28th, not long after 9 o'clock East Coast time, President Obama will say something like this. The state of our union, he will say, is strong. There will be policy prescriptions and shout-outs to people in the hall. A lot of talk this year about what a president can do without Congress having to approve. He's also expected, Mr. Obama is, to announce a new plan aimed at helping the long-term unemployed, Americans who've been out of work 6 months or more. The president wants companies to promise they won't discriminate against the long-term unemployed when they're hiring. AT&T, Xerox, and Lockheed Martin are among the big names that have said to be signed on already. But really, how much good is a corporate promise when jobs are on the line? Marketplace's Noel King has the story.
Robin Swirling lost her job in July of 2012.
I started looking and working my connections the day I got laid off.
It took her a year to find a new one. Sometimes she could feel this creeping sense of doubt from potential employers.
When you've been looking for a while and you've been interviewing places and you've gotten several interviews, it certainly starts to make people wonder why you haven't gotten picked up by somebody.
Robin thinks the bias may have been unconscious, maybe even understandable, but it was there. David DeSalvo, a science and technology writer for Forbes, says when a hiring manager is conducting an interview, they're also acting as a risk assessor. Applicants who have been out of work for a long time set off alarms. What goes through the hiring manager's head is something like this.
Well, when this person comes on board, we're going to have to invest X amount of money, time, resources to ramp them up to the job.
And this.
People, when they're out of work for a while, fall into patterns of behavior that are not conducive to a, you know, hard working style. You know, they're not used to getting up and having to get in a car and drive to the office, you know, deal with the commute.
DeSalvo says that if President Obama's initiative is to work, hiring managers will have to let go of those biases. Robin Swirling says employers should consider this. If someone lands a job after 6 months, a year, 2 years of looking, they're probably going to work really, really hard. I'm Noel King for Marketplace.
Stocks, which we will get to in due time, of course, didn't do too badly today. Our stocks, anyway. They were down, but nothing like Friday when the bottom fell out, relatively speaking, on fears of emerging market instability and currency declines, phrases that nobody wants to hear. Tim Fernholz is a reporter for Quartz. Hey, Tim.
Hello, Kai.
These are big, scary words, right? Emerging market meltdown, currency problems. What exactly, in layman's terms, is going on here?
Well, what's going on is that a lot of economies around the world, countries that were doing pretty good, in fact, that we were like, they're doing better than the United States generally, have been running into some troubles in the last 6 months to a year. And in some cases, those troubles are really coming to a head right now. And the way we can tell is that it is a lot easier for American dollars or even euros and other sort of currencies to buy the foreign currency in these troubled economies.
Right, which happens on the foreign exchange markets. This is, in a way, related to the Federal Reserve Bank of the United States, right?
It is. Last spring, Ben Bernanke, the Federal Reserve Chair, began hinting that the Fed was going to stop buying so many bonds, a thing it is doing to keep the U.S. economy going forward, and start to go back to normal. And it didn't even get a chance to stop before these emerging market currencies started to sell off. Because people are worried as the U.S. starts to have higher interest rates, more and more money is going to come back to the United States and to other developed economies, leaving these emerging economies kind of outside without a coat, let's say.
All right, fair enough. And let's remember that back in the late 90s, it was emerging markets that started some of the currency problems back then and the ripple effects of a meltdown back then. Why, though, today should somebody in the United States be worried about this?
Well, the easiest way to put it is that of the big corporations on the S&P 500 stock index, biggest corporations in the U.S., basically, mm-hmm. half of their revenue comes from outside the United States.
Oh.
So if you look at big companies that we think of as American companies like General Electric, General Motors, Walmart, you name it, these companies are making a lot of their money overseas. And if economic problems are happening overseas, their bottom line isn't going to look so good. Their stock market numbers aren't going to look so good. And if your retirement fund is invested in any of these companies or in a stock market index, as it probably should be, you might see it go down. And in fact, we've seen U.S. markets sort of sinking a little as these emerging markets have been troubled in the last week or so.
Spitball it for me. Does this, and with full acknowledgement and disclaimer that you're winging it, does this get worse or is it going to stabilize? Once people get used to the idea of the Fed tapering and seeing the world's not ending.
Well, I think it's going to be okay. Let me reassure you on that front with all my expertise. People are hearkening back to this late 90s foreign currency crisis when Alan Greenspan and Larry Summers, you may remember them, had to have the committee to save the world.
Right, committee to save the world. Yeah, you beat me to it.
Bingo, yeah. And that was pretty terrifying because it seemed like these problems were just migrating from country to country. And we couldn't figure out how to really stop them. And it affected a lot of places across the world. What people are saying now, and if you know finance, you'll be a little nervous when I say this, is this time is different.
Yeah.
And the reason is...
yeah. Never has more money been lost on a simple phrase than this time is different, right?
I would remind you all that I'm not an investment advisor.
That's right.
What is different now is people are making the case, basically, that there are differences between the different hurting countries right now, and it's not going to be a mass contagion sort of panic event like it was in the late 90s.
Fingers crossed, right?
Fingers crossed all the time watching these markets.
Always. Tim Fernholz, he writes for Quartz. Tim, thanks a bunch.
Pleasure to be here.
All right, let's just close the loop here. Wall Street today. Yeah, it could have been worse. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. One of the biggest fights in education these days, and there are a lot of big fights, I'll grant you that. But this one is over something known as the Common Core, new standards that are aimed at getting kids better prepared for college and then careers. The Common Core has been adopted in most states, although there are fights brewing in a couple of places. And that latter list now includes New York, where the Board of Trustees of the huge and hugely powerful New York State Teachers Union voted this weekend not to support the standards, at least as they have been implemented so far. From the education desk at WYPR Marketplace's Amy Scott has that story.
When New York tested its students on the Common Core last year, more than two-thirds of them failed. Teachers say they didn't have enough time to really teach the new math and English standards, and they're being judged on the results. On Saturday, the union leadership voted no confidence in State Education Commissioner John King and called for a three-year moratorium on, quote, high-stakes consequences from standardized testing. Randy Weingarten is president of the American Federation of Teachers, the national union.
This is a really big transition, and instead of actually doing it thoughtfully and preparing teachers and preparing parents, John King has put his foot on the accelerator of testing.
The vote is yet another setback for the Common Core. Teachers and parents don't like the emphasis on testing. Conservatives don't like the Obama administration's role in promoting the standards. Sonia Brookin-Santelises with the Education Trust says the New York vote is a wake-up call.
That we need to be really thoughtful about the implementation of the Common Core and that we need to hear very seriously what the field is saying.
Most states have put off new testing to give teachers more time to adjust, and lots of teachers still support the Common Core. But, says Michael Petrilli with the conservative Fordham Institute,
there are many, many states, conservative states, where there are bills that have been introduced to pull the state out of the Common Core, and, you know, it's going to be a big fight.
A fight he hopes President Obama will stay out of in his State of the Union address tomorrow night. He says the president's mentioned it 2 years running, and it hasn't helped. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Google has plus or minus $50 billion cash on hand, 50 billion. So it's been on something of a buying spree of late. Its most recent acquisition is a London-based startup called DeepMind Technologies. DeepMind as in artificial intelligence. No details yet on the price tag. There are some guesses out there of as much as $500 million for, it must be said, a company that hasn't launched any products yet. So, if you're a startup, what's the magic formula for attracting Google's attention? Here's Marketplace's Sarah Gardner.
Think of it this way. Google is like the big man on campus, the tech campus. And there's a bunch of startups who love a long-term relationship with the BMOC. So, how to win Google's affections? First off, it helps to be scary smart and not just an out-of-the-box thinker. Global equities research analyst Trip Chowdhury says Google wants exponential thinkers.
What is an exponential thinker? Is a person who can think 10 years, 20 years, 100 years ahead, and then bring all that view of the future in present.
Which is apparently what DeepMind has. The startup's founders include artificial intelligence experts and a neuroscientist described as a boy genius. DeepMind specializes in helping computers think more like humans, which is the other thing turning Google on right now.
Because the idea is to change the world by computing intelligence.
Think Google's driverless cars, or its purchase last year of Boston Dynamics, which makes robots for the military. Silicon Valley entrepreneur Steve Blank says Google is branching out, just like Apple did when it decided it was more than a computer company.
I think Google realizes that its entire eggs are in one basket, and smart companies don't do that.
Analyst Chowdhury says if you're a startup pining for Google's affections, just show them you have the smarts and vision to help create whole new industries, and then push innovation to the limit. That's all. I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
We started a new segment a couple of weeks ago. Your questions, our answers, those niggling little things about business and economics that have been bugging you. It's called I've Always Wondered.
If you wonder.
By asking 1,000 questions to get one answer, by brain work and labor.
It can be anything, stuff you can't figure out or something you want to know more about. Here's Marketplace's Mark Garrison with the latest installment.
Today's question comes from Allison Najman. Allison, what have you always wondered?
Why do luxury hotels most of the time charge for Wi-Fi, but cheaper hotels don't?
You're in North Carolina, but by the power vested in me by Kai Rizdahl, I can teleport you to New York, where we will test your question's premise. Come along. Allison, we're now in New York's Waldorf Astoria. The lobby is enormous and elegant. There are staffers everywhere, a check-in desk, concierge desk, dining area. Here, the presidential suite really is. President Obama stays here. It's pretty nice, eh?
Yeah, this is beautiful.
I found a room tonight for $399. Allison, what do you think Wi-Fi costs?
I would expect it to be free at a $400 a night hotel room, but I'm sure it's probably about $15 a night.
Close, it's $19.95 per day. Now let's check out a different hotel. It's just downtown, but since we can teleport, let's do that.
Good afternoon, Hotel 17.
This is Hotel 17. The lobby is small and basic. Instead of a giant staff, there's just a guy. You can stay here tonight for $86, a very good deal in New York. It's not nearly as nice as the Waldorf, but the Wi-Fi is free. As for why many expensive hotels charge for access and budget ones don't, let's call up Toni Rapetti. She's a hotel management professor at University of Nevada, Las Vegas.
The easy answer to that is because they can.
Allison, are we all good? Was that the answer you were looking for?
It was not satisfying because that's the reason everyone charges for something is because they can.
Okay, let's go a little deeper. The reason why luxury hotels can charge involves their customers' price sensitivity. That's the key economic concept here. Jeff Beck is a former Marriott exec who teaches at Michigan State's business school.
The type of people that are going to be staying there are typically there on business, which generally means that somebody else is paying for it.
Since they can stick their bosses with the bill, business travelers are hardly price sensitive at all. As for the folks staying at fancy hotels for pleasure, Rapetti says their wealth means they're not very price sensitive either.
A $20 fee on a $400-plus room night is probably not a big deal when they're paying $400 for a room.
But budget hotel customers are definitely price sensitive, and managers know it.
They have to have that amenity for you to stay there, so they have to include Wi-Fi.
So, Allison, do you see how price sensitivity is why fancy hotels charge for Wi-Fi?
Yes, but that doesn't make it the right answer in 2014, right? You know, you can get free internet at Starbucks.
The good news is things are changing. The website Hotel Chatter has a long-running survey of hotel Wi-Fi. It says nearly two-thirds of hotels offer it free, and that number's growing. Managing editor Juliana Shellcross says guests are driving that shift.
When they go to a hotel and they see that it's charging them for Wi-Fi, they get a little pissed off, and I think they make that known.
Hotels don't want angry customers in the age of online reviews and social media. Companies that give hotels a lot of business are complaining, too. So many hotels are getting rid of Wi-Fi charges, but Tony Rapetti at UNLV points out that free hotel Wi-Fi may not be quite so free.
They also are increasing their room rates to make up for that. You may not see that, but they are increasing even a little bit.
Average rates are up about $5. Allison, here's a tip before you go. If you're stuck at a hotel charging for Wi-Fi, ask about their loyalty program. Often they'll waive Wi-Fi fees if you join. Thanks for the question. In New York, I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
Well, it's 1, 2, 3, 4, take the elevator at the hotel you're behind. I'm glad to see you later. All they got inside is vacancy.
There's a whole bunch of fun stuff on our website about hotels, including a quiz and the story behind all of those Gideon Bibles in those bedside tables when you're on the road. And, of course, we are always looking for fodder. Your questions for I've Always Wondered at Marketplace.org. Coming up, parents and their cell phones.
In September, you talk for 307 minutes, and I talk for 94 minutes.
Really?
Yeah. But first, let's do the numbers. Yeah, we stayed firmly in the red today, everybody. The Dow Industrial's off another 41 points, about a quarter percent. Closed at 15,837. The NASDAQ belted down 44 points, 1.1%, ended things at 4,083. The S&P 500 down 8 points, about a half percent, closed at 1,781. Caterpillar tracked up nearly 6% today after it released good earnings. Sony, though, slid nearly 3% after its debt was downgraded to junk. Biotech took a bath led by Alexion Pharmaceuticals, which slipped 2.8%. Celgene Corp, which fell 3% today. Facebook folded 1.6%. LinkedIn crumbled 5.5%. Twitter dove more than 6% today. Bond prices up. The yield on the 10-year T-note down to 2.76%. You're listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Tuesday. In Washington, the Federal Reserve begins a two-day meeting on interest rates. Do appliances and computers make good holiday gifts? The Census Bureau reports on durable goods orders for December. And MASH star Alan Alda turns 78. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdal. One of the things that people do when economies slow down is go back to school. Transition training for new skills. Sometimes a graduate degree. Law school was really popular for a while there. Even sometimes a doctorate. But PhDs don't come cheap. And in fact, consultant Karen Kelski says getting a doctorate can cost you more than it's worth. She runs a business that is in part about finding jobs for students with doctorates. Karen, welcome to the program.
Hi, Kai.
I will confess that I thought all those PhD students out there, or candidates, I guess they're called, I thought they were all fully funded and didn't have to worry about money for nothing.
Right. Well, many of them are fully funded, but unfortunately, the stipends that are on offer in these full funding packages are not adequate to support the actual expenses of most adult lives.
How come?
Well, the answer to that starts with the massive defunding of higher education in the United States. Basically, it has become a revenue-driven institution. And so departments and programs that don't generate revenue in the way that the sciences or engineering or business do, find themselves defunded. And so consequently, in the humanities and social sciences, a typical stipend will be about $15,000.
Wow, which almost anywhere is not enough to get by.
Almost anywhere is not enough to get by.
How much debt, then, do typical PhD candidates wind up amassing? And I understand that this is probably different based on your field of study.
It's absolutely different because the folks who are in the hard sciences or in engineering or other fields, they have a completely different funding model because they are not among the defunded.
Right. And they can get out, more importantly, and make bank, right?
They can. Yeah. They can. So their prospects are different as well, even if they were to accrue the debt, which they don't accrue to begin with. But in any case, in the humanities and the soft social sciences, debt can go anywhere from, of course, zero to up to $250,000.
Wow.
And they were in fields like religious studies and sociology, women's studies, and things like that.
We should say, and I probably should have said it earlier, that you are a PhD yourself. You were a tenured professor of anthropology, right?
Yes.
And you were in academia professionally for a while. How much debt did you pile up for your PhD?
I did not accrue any debt for my PhD because I finished my PhD in 1996, and I had full funding. The full funding was not extravagant by any means, but it was sufficient for me to scrape by and make ends meet and be able to complete my program without any debt at all.
It is kind of interesting, though, that you, having been in academia and having done this PhD thing yourself and now being sharply critical of the mechanism of it, are assisting people get jobs in academia.
Mm-hmm. You're not the first to point out contradiction of my position. The fact is that I still firmly believe in the value of academia. So my work is really to tell the truth about it and to demystify it on behalf of individual job seekers so that they can understand the black box of university hiring and teach them strategies and give them resources to optimize their chances for success.
Karen Kelsky is an academic career consultant. Her website is theprofessorisin.com. And Karen, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you, Kai.
Alongside the traditional parental threats of don't make me come up there and we'll get there when we get there, all right? There's another one that's becoming popular in this digital age. Put the phone down before I take it away. Well, turns out there's a certain amount of parental looking in the mirror that ought to be happening here. Youth Radio's Maya Escobar reports.
For this story, I decided to start at home.
Thank you for doing this, puppy.
You're welcome.
Can you introduce yourself to me?
My name is Jose Escobar, and I am Maya's father.
There's a little piece of irony there. Did you hear it? It was this part.
Can you introduce yourself to me?
My dad's cell phone vibrates with a message at the very beginning of an interview. An interview where I try to convince him that he's addicted to his phone. Does he think he's addicted?
No.
But when I ask him if he thinks I'm addicted...
Yeah, definitely. You need to text less. You know, you text too much. You know, you're constantly reading what's on Facebook. So you need to take a break.
I think he needs to take a break. Whenever my dad comes to pick me up from school, my sister and I sit in the car for 5 minutes before he starts the engine. Because his eyes are glued to his phone, just like they were during my interview with him.
See, you're even holding your phone now. What are you looking at?
Yeah, I guess it's just a habit.
Habit means that you're not thinking about what you're doing. It's an automatic kind of reaction.
Scott Campbell is a communications professor at the University of Michigan. He studies the way mobile devices affect people. Habit, says Campbell, is not about how much a person uses their cell phone. It's about intentionality. Are you using it for a reason?
I think people use mobile technology in a more reflexive way. And I think this is one of the important reasons why people are still texting and driving when they know it is so dangerous.
Texting while driving. That's what teens do, right? Actually, a 2012 survey found that adults admit to texting and driving even more than teens.
That's really awful, actually.
Parent Jamie Burke used to argue with her dad when she was a kid. She was always trying to get him to quit smoking. Now, she says, her kids are on her to give up a different bad habit.
When I text and drive, my younger son will actually say to me, Mom, I don't want you to end up dead. Because he sees all the ads where they'll show their very last text and then they'll show the car crunched and the person dead. And so that does make me think about it, but then I still do it, actually, to be honest.
Work emails are a big part of Burke's usage. Texting, too. Sometimes, she admits, her kids compete for her attention.
They'll say, look at me in the eye, and then sometimes I'll try to text and look at them, or text and take a break and then look at them as I'm texting.
The only way I could think to convince my dad that he uses the phone more than he thinks was to sit him down and take a cold, hard look at the numbers.
In September, you talked for 307 minutes and I talked for 94 minutes.
Really?
To find out who is really addicted, I took the average from 3 months of phone records. It turns out my dad talks twice as much as I do, but I text way more. The tiebreaker? Data. He used more than me.
Well, I wonder why, because... Oh, yeah, because I was watching some boxing on my phone. That's probably why I used more.
So, I guess that makes me the undisputed champion of cell phone self-control. In Oakland, California, I'm Maya Escobar for Marketplace.
Maya's story came to us from Youth Radio.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note on the way out today, in which the National Security Agency stoops to previously unimagined depths, courtesy of the New York Times, The Guardian over in the UK, and ultimately, of course, Edward Snowden. We learned today that the NSA really loves smartphone apps. There's a huge amount of personal data in some of them. Google Maps is an NSA favorite, apparently, which makes sense. Location data, travels, all of that. Also, though, on the list of apps they are interested in, and here is the unimagined part, Angry Birds. Really? Angry Birds? What do they learn from Angry Birds? Somebody write me. Tell me. All right, we're done. That's Marketplace from 8 p.m. Today, the Dow off 41 points, about 0.25%. The NASDAQ lost 44 points. That's 1.1%. The S&P 500 down 8 points. That's 0.5%. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bodner and Tommy Andres. Millie Jefferson directs the program. I'm Kai Rizdahl. I speak on the radio. We'll see you tomorrow. This is 8 p.m.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.